Jill Tarter and Tyler Nordgren this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with a conversation in a place called Death Valley about life across the universe. Astronomer, engineer, and SETI pioneer Jill Tarter will join astronomer, artist, and night photographer of the national parks, Tyler Nordgren, for a very special conversation. Bruce Betts has big sky news in this week's What's Up segment, and you'll get the chance to win some of Tyler Nordgren's spectacular posters. Emily Lakdawalla is the Planetary Society's senior editor. She just wrote about the Mars Science Laboratory rover's latest accomplishment. Emily, yeah, I know we talked about Curiosity just last week, but it's not every day that the rover drills a new hole.
That's right. There's only been 10 of them since the rover landed, and this is the 10th at a site called Lubengo on the western edge of the Nauclift Plateau on Mars.
Why this spot?
Well, they're just about to drive off of the top of this plateau that's made of a rock unit called the Stimson Unit, which they've been driving across for a while. And this is really their last chance to sample it. And as they've driven across the Stimson, they've seen these places where the rock is fractured. And there's these light-toned zones around the fractures that maybe they were altered by fluids going through the rock. Maybe the fluids leached out some material, or maybe the fluids seeped into the rock and deposited some new elements. And those are the kinds of questions. What exactly is happening around these fractures that the Curiosity team is trying to test by drilling into a site in one of these halos around a fracture? And then pretty soon they're going to drill into a location outside a fracture, and then they'll be able to compare the two to each other.
Now, am I right that Curiosity can only do so many of these holes, or at least can only analyze the material from so many of them?
The limitation is really more time and complexity than anything else. Curiosity's drill, of course, couldn't drill an unlimited number of rocks on Mars, but the rocks seem to be pretty soft, the drill showing no signs of wear and tear. The Kemen can continue analyzing with X-ray diffraction as many samples as you need. The SAM instrument has a limited number of sample cups and a limited amount of helium to move air around inside the instrument. So that's got a more limited timeline. But still, Curiosity could easily do double as many drill holes, probably triple, without much of a problem. So that's really not the limitation. The limitation is just how hard it is to get to these sites and to do all the work that Curiosity needs to do to analyze them.
You've included your compilation of all 10 of these holes, these portraits of holes in Mars. Anything that we can learn from this? Or there seems to be a good deal of variety to my non-geologist eyes.
There is quite a bit of variety, but in most of the holes, you get to the conclusion that is actually one of the more interesting conclusions from Curiosity, which is that Mars is red on the outside and gray on the inside.
I bet we're going to learn a lot more. In fact, we already have learned a lot more than that, right, Emily?
That's for sure.
She is the senior editor for the Planetary Society, our planetary evangelist. And over at Sky and Telescope magazine, she's a contributing editor. That's Emily Lakdawalla. I'll talk to you again next week.
See you then, Matt.
Next, we go to Death Valley for a visit with Jill Tarter and Tyler Nordgren. On April 8th, I made the long drive to the vast wonderland known as Death Valley National Park. The United States National Park System is celebrating 100 years of preservation and sharing of unparalleled natural wonder and historic heritage. The rangers in Death Valley have no shortage of spectacular beauty to share, but they decided to look skyward in what they called a celestial centennial. There were 3 days of great events and activities. I was there to host a conversation with two amazing scientists, Jill Tarter and Tyler Nordgren. Our topics went far beyond what we have time for on the air. They included inspiring discussion of the sense of awe that drives Jill, Tyler, and so many other scientists. You can hear all of it in the online version of the show at planetary.org/radio. More about Tyler after the break. Jill, of course, provided Carl Sagan with the inspiration for the main character in his great novel Contact, which later became the equally great film starring Jodie Foster. She has held the Bernard M. Oliver Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Chair at the Institute for nearly 20 years and is on the management board for the Allen Telescope Array, that amazing collection of dishes that searches the skies from Northern California. Among her awards are the Ted Prize and two public service medals from NASA.
Jill, how goes the search?
Well, the search goes on. We use the Allen Telescope Array every day. We have recently, because of the results of Kepler, that essentially every star has a planet, we have just last week changed our modality of observing. We had been observing all the exoplanet systems that were known. But now we've started observing 20,000 red dwarf stars, which are much closer to us. Many of them haven't been observed or planets haven't been found, but statistically we know they should be there. And so we've changed and we're looking at our closest neighbors.
And I heard Seth Shostak talking about that at the Contact Conference just last weekend. These are very common stars, right? There are lots of opportunities. What's the current thinking about the Goldilocks zone, the habitability zone around these small, dim stars?
Well, actually, SETI researchers for a very long time didn't bother looking at red dwarfs. Here's the problem. These are small, dim stars. If you want to have a planet close enough to that star to be warm so that you could have liquid water on the surface, and that's something, yes, it's a bias, it's a anthropomorphism, perhaps, but we think liquid water is necessary for life. If you want to have a planet close enough to be warm enough to have liquid water on its surface, if it had an atmosphere, then what's going to happen is the planet gets tidally locked to the star. So it gets in the same configuration as we have with our moon, where one face of the planet faces the moon, or, I'm sorry, the star all the time. Therefore, we thought back then, oh, well, gee, you'll boil off any atmosphere on the front side, you'll freeze it out on the back side. That's not going to be really good for life. You know, it turns out that you have to think a little more deeply. And indeed, we now think that winds and perhaps oceans could circulate the heat from the star, the sun side around to the back side. And there might be a zone that is temperate and good for life. But then there's all this controversy about these stars flare a lot when they're young. Maybe the atmosphere gets blown away. We don't know. But they are closer to us. They allow observers of all flavors to study them better than more distant objects. And so they're kind of the bandwagon that everyone's jumping on. From those who are interested in looking for microbes to my team that's interested in finding mathematicians.
Don't they also have extraordinarily long lives? I mean, they're going to be around a long time.
That's quite true. There has never been a red dwarf star that has been born, that has died in the history of the galaxy. They're all still alive. They live more than 10 billion years.
Which leads me to something that your colleague, Seth Shostak, talked about, and tells a lot of people about nowadays. And this has been known for years. It's been speculated that we're less than babies, we humans, if there is an advanced civilization out there, one that got over that technology hump and didn't wipe themselves out that you talked about, they're likely to be far, far ahead of us, and they may not look much like us. In fact, they might be machines. He said, we may be looking and listening for the wrong thing. What do you think?
First of all, yes, truth in advertising, we may be looking and listening for the wrong thing. It may be that we should be looking for zeta rays, but I don't know what a zeta ray is, right? So you're stuck with the technology you have. And we have the technology of the 21st century.
And our technology just failed. We
yes.
just had a blackout.
Right. So it's a good thing you've got a battery on here.
Appropriate. That was really well timed. How'd you do that, Jill? All right, we'll see if we can get the projector back in a second. Sorry.
So you're stuck with what you know and what you have, and you try and do the best job you can. So we have the tools of the astronomers of the 21st century, or we're building tools that are somewhat related. Hopefully that's looking for the right thing. And even if, as Seth is fond of saying, the intelligence on a distant planet is post-biological, doesn't mean that they can't build radio transmitters. And they might reach back to their primitive technologies, their old technologies, instruments that are in museums for ancient technology, as transmitters to attract the attention of the emerging technologies, the young kids on the block, which is what we are.
And let's hope they don't have a prime directive that prevents them from using that old technology to try and talk to us backward folks. There is, of course, that group of people, smart people, who worry that it's okay to listen, but don't talk. Don't send any messages out, because then the Klingons will know where to find us.
If the Klingons are within 100 light years, they know where to find us anyway. That's about how long we have been leaking electromagnetic radiation of one form or another, starting with our early radio broadcasts. That horse is out of the barn. The discussion in the community today is whether or not we should be deliberately transmitting with more power in order to attract attention. I mean, as some people argue, if everybody listens and nobody transmits, it's not going to work real well. On the other hand, you've just pointed out that any technology out there is going to be older than ours. It can't be younger and have us detect it. I mean, we are kind of the minimum in this game. You might argue that for the young, emerging technology, you do the easy thing first, which is listen, put the onus on the older technology to do the harder job of transmitting. And then when we grow up, we have a responsibility to transmit as well. There are all shades of this argument. What I'm looking for is a tool so that we can have a meaningful global discussion. Now, we've had meetings on this topic for decades, and the people in the room, white, Anglo-Saxon, male, mostly, there are so many cultures and traditions that have never had a voice at the table that I would really like to take this conversation globally. If any of you know of good tools, I'm beginning to study something called Liquid Freedom, coming out of Germany, a very democratic process that claims to be able to hold a global conversation and not get spammed and not get dominated by the loudest voice. And I'm really interested in looking into that. But any other tool that people know of? Because let's get this discussion underway and decide. It's one of the kinds of existential questions that we're dealing with in other areas. Things that are hard to answer could have good or bad consequences. But let's have the conversation.
Jill Tarter of the SETI Institute. We'll hear more from her, and we'll meet Tyler Nordgren when Planetary Radio continues from Death Valley National Park.
This is Robert Picardo. I've been a member of the Planetary Society since my Star Trek Voyager days. You may have even heard me on several episodes of Planetary Radio. Now I'm proud to be the newest member of the Board of Directors. I'll be able to do even more to help the Society achieve its goals for space exploration across our solar system and beyond. You can join me in this exciting quest. The journey starts at planetary.org. I'll see you there.
Do you know what your favorite presidential candidate thinks about space exploration? Hi, I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy. You can learn that answer and what all the other candidates think at planetary.org/election2016. You know what? We could use your help. If you find anything we've missed, you can let us know. It's all at planetary.org/election2016. Thank you.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, welcoming you back on our recent visit to Death Valley National Park for a conversation with two inspiring individuals. We've already heard from SETI researcher Jill Tarter, so let's meet Tyler Nordgren. Tyler is a full professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Redlands in California, where he utilizes some of our planet's greatest observatories to conduct his research on dark matter, variable stars, and more. But Tyler is also a talented artist. He and Bill Nye were on the team that designed the Mars Dial sundials for the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, along with the third Mars Dial on the great Curiosity rover, now climbing the red planet's Mount Sharp. He has worked with the U.S. National Park Service for more than 10 years to promote astronomy education. His gorgeous 2010 book, Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks, is a big hit at the Planetary Society, which helped to get it published. And then there are his wonderful posters promoting the parks and the night sky. You can check them out at tylernordgren.com. Again, you can hear my entire conversation with Jill and Tyler at planetary.org/radio.
Tyler, this is not precisely your field. You largely deal with that stuff that makes up most of the universe that none of us can see and, or for that matter, figure out what it is so far. But do you find this topic of SETI and the possibility of life elsewhere, does that generate the same kind of sense of awe in you?
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the things that as a kid, as a boy, I looked up at the sky and wondered what was out there. Were there any other civilizations around any of those stars looking back at me? And the fact that in my day job, I'm a professor at a small liberal arts college. We were just having a class on this just last week, and the discussion in that room about should we listen, should we broadcast, what will it be like if we ever hear from somebody else? That is the thing that captures generation after generation of their passion and interest.
But not politicians.
Maybe they'll come around someday.
Exactly. But you cannot be a living, thinking, breathing person and not be fascinated. And hence, maybe that is why it leaves out politicians.
Maybe when the generation that grew up on movies like Contact and Bill Nye the Science Guy, maybe when they get into positions of power in Congress, maybe things will change.
Well, I had the great pleasure of going to the White House last October as part of the White House Astronomy Night. And there, standing on the South Lawn, President Barack Obama came out and talked about the wonders of astronomy to inspire the generations. And he talked about this young boy in Brooklyn who grew up and wanted to learn about the stars, and he became Carl Sagan. And what Carl Sagan did to inspire the next generation, and I fully admit, I was of that generation. I was a child when Cosmos came out, and I bought a book with my allowance, read along each week, and I teach out of that book today. And so the cycle of inspiration continues.
Let's get into some more of your work. And it starts, maybe, with this next book.
So for those that may not be familiar, and I'm part of a task force of astronomers trying to get the word out, in 2017, there's going to be a total solar eclipse that's going to cross the United States. It'll be the first time totality has been visible from the U.S. since 1979. I was a 9-year-old boy when that happened, living up in Portland, Oregon, where the path of totality, the shadow of the moon, crossed the world. And because of the local TV and news broadcasts, I thought for sure that if I accidentally looked at the sun while it was eclipsed, my eyes would burn out. And so I hid inside with the curtains drawn and watched on TV. And not a year has gone by, I haven't felt cheated out of something awe-inspiring. So we are getting the word out that in 2017, August 21st, it's a Monday, the moon's shadow will cross the entire U.S., and every single man, woman, and child in the United States will get to see at least a partial eclipse. And for those 9 million people living within this diagonal band from Oregon to South Carolina, they will get to see the sun turn black, the sky grow dark, the temperature drop, the brightest stars come out, and this ghostly corona stretch around the sun. And it truly is awe-inspiring.
And might be worth a trip into the path of totality, which unfortunately doesn't cross very many big cities or even big towns.
People are going to want to move. People are going to want to travel. Half of St. Louis, half of Kansas City, all of Nashville will be in the shadow. Jackson, Wyoming. So there's a lot of beautiful, beautiful places people can go to. And if you make the effort, go out, see the sun, and then stay for the night, because solar eclipses happen at new moon, and so that night the stars will come out. So go for the sun, stay for the stars.
So you obviously got past that bad eclipse experience.
I did, and I was a Boy Scout up in Oregon, and so we went out to the Cascade Mountains, and I got to see a sky full of stars. And then being of that generation when Cosmos came on TV and Carl Sagan talked about how essentially being a scientist was the most human thing that one could do, that it was the intersection of art and philosophy and history, and wondering about our place in the universe, I couldn't think of anything more worthwhile to do with my time.
Jill, you're nodding in agreement.
Yeah, like Tyler, when I was young, 6, 8 is what I remember, I got to go with my dad and walk along the beaches of Manasota Key, which is on the west side of Florida. The key was jungle. It was had my aunt and uncle and maybe a couple of other crazy people living on it. It was such dark skies walking along the ocean there. And I remember looking up and wondering whether on the planet, on one of those stars, there was a young creature walking along an ocean with its parent looking back at me. Exactly the same experience. And so I have always felt that possibility.
And one of the things that's just amazing about this generation is, as you spoke earlier about planets around other stars, this is the generation where we are finding these planets, and when, however far into the future it is that our interstellar spaceships ever finally make those trips, the places that they will go will probably be the places that were found in this generation. This is an amazing time to be doing this.
This has been everything I hoped it would be, except longer. But I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Please help me thank these two wonderful human beings and scientists, Jill Carver and Tyler Morgan.
We're grateful to all the terrific people at Death Valley National Park and to the National Park Service for making this show possible. Bruce Batts is here for this week's edition of What's Up. I had hoped to join him in person to record this one, but I was just too sick, and I'm getting there. I'm getting better. Thank you for asking before we recorded.
you're welcome. Yeah, Matt's had it rough. I got healthy quite rapidly, but Matt's been taken out of action.
I just love feeling sorry for myself and being supported in that. Make me feel better with What's Up.
Well, just to try to make you feel better, Matt, because you've been sick, I've arranged for Mercury Transit.
Oh, you're so kind.
On May 9th, Mercury transits in front of the sun, passes between the sun and the Earth. It will, over several hours, appear as a small dot moving across the sun. The best way to observe this is with a telescope with proper safety filters. Don't stare at the sun without proper safety filters. But you're going to need some type of telescopic nodule, or you can use things like pinholes to project an image of the sun onto paper or the ground. I know there are places that will be covering this online with solar telescopes, so you can check it out. For us on West Coast, North America, it will rise already in transit. The sun will. The last Mercury transit, Matt, was in 2006, the next one in 2019. They're erratic. You get 11 or 12 per year. Per year. Not per year. Wouldn't that be cool? Per century. I'm going with century.
Wouldn't be nearly as cool if it was per year.
Oh, there you go. Probably impossible to see just with your eyes and solar filters, much less without them. Which case, you will burn your eyes out. So don't do that.
Good advice, as always.
Jupiter super bright in the south, Mars and Saturn coming up in the east later on in the evening. But Mercury transit is the focus. On to this week in space history. Hard to believe it was 26 years ago this week that the Hubble Space Telescope was deployed.
Oh, good Lord.
1990.
So it went out of service, like had to be 10, 12, 15 years ago, right? Nothing could last that long.
It's true. It's true. No, they're still using it, Matt. And it got various upgrades over the years. It's still doing that mediocre kind of work that it does. That was sarcasm. On to Random Space Fact.
Lovely.
On June 3rd, 2014, the Curiosity rover on the planet Mars observed the planet Mercury transiting the Sun, marking the first time ever a planetary transit had been observed from any planet other than Earth.
I forgot about that. I remember now seeing the images of that. Doing astronomy from Mars. It's a good time to be alive.
It is indeed. All right, we move on to the trivia contest. We asked you, what moon has a massive equatorial ridge running 3/4 of the way around the moon? How'd we do, Matt?
So many people not only got this right, but said they knew it off the top of their head, as if they carry a walnut around on their head. I'm not sure what that means. I'm not feeling well. This is the walnut moon, Iapetus, right?
Yes, indeed. Iapetus, moon of Saturn, has a belly band, a walnut ridge.
And we're going to come back to that belly band, that midriff bulge that Iapetus has. David Fisher, who was chosen by random.org, I believe a first-time winner who got it right, he says, sure enough, Iapetus. He lives in Craigmore, which is in Australia, a little bit north of Adelaide. He is, for his trouble, going to be receiving a Planetary Radio t-shirt, a 200-point iTelescope astronomy account, and a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, which seems to be a very coveted item right now. Speaking of the walnut, Daniel Kazard is warning away all those giant space squirrels. Leave that moon alone.
Space squirrels.
I hope
next
you would like that.
On the Sci-Fi Channel.
They would, wouldn't they? David Dearden, he's in Mapleton, Utah. He talked about the ridge and said, if you really want to see it at its best, watch that amazing film, that awe-inspiring, fabulous short film by Eric Wernquist called Wanderers, which I had to go back and look it up. It's on Vimeo. It is absolutely spectacular. And it shows humans living on the ridge on Iapetus. You really have to see it. That's like the least of what it has to show off. Katie Fritchard, she mentioned that it was first discovered, the moon, that is, by Cassini. And fun fact, the ridge was found in 2004 by the Cassini mission. So a nice coincidence there. But I also wanted to mention Katie because of her special greeting to Louisa and Brittany. Woot! Go space! I'm guessing there's a relationship there somewhere.
Probably.
Dave Fairchild is on his game. You ready for his latest poem for us?
I am indeed.
When speaking of Iapetus, this fact I will divulge, it has a ridge around it, an unsightly muffin bulge. When Phoebe said, you're gaining weight, the moon would just deny it. Like many midlife astro fans, he should go on a diet. Thank you, Dave.
I find the bulge attractive.
Me too. I think it's kind of cute.
Back to transits of Mercury. When was the first recorded observation of a transit of Mercury across the Sun, and by whom? Who made the observation? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
I like that. You'll need to get us this response by Tuesday, May 3rd at 8 a.m. Pacific time. And having just listened to Tyler Nordgren on the program, that wonderful astronomer and artist, how would you like to win three, count them, three of his terrific posters? Because we've got a bunch to give away. So that's what the winner's going to get this time, in addition to an iTelescope.net account, of course, that 200-point account on that worldwide network of telescopes operated on a nonprofit basis out of Australia, where our winner was from this week. So not bad, not bad at all.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about horses. Thank you, and good night.
He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. He ponies up every week here on What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its wide-eyed members. Josh Doyle created our theme music. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.